I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In her political career, Jolie Justice has served two terms as a state senator. She currently represents Kansas City's 4th District on the city council. And now, Justice looks to extend her time in public service by winning the race for mayor of the city. Today, a conversation with the candidate on development incentives, affordable housing, transportation, and the other issues voters have said are important to them. Then, since the weekend is shaping up to be perfect for staying indoors, UpToDate's film critics are here with reviews of the latest indie, documentary, and foreign films now showing, from ballet great Rudolf Nureyev to farming in L.A. to the KGB's longest-serving British spy. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Years in the Missouri Senate, where she was Democratic leader, 4 years on the Kansas City Council, where she's chaired the airport and legislative committees, the top vote getter in April's primary election with 23% of the vote. And come June 18th, she and her fellow council member, Quentin Lucas, hope to be elected the 57th mayor of Kansas City. We'll have Councilman Lucas on the show next week, but today we're talking with Councilwoman Jolie Justice. Welcome back to Up to Date.
Great to be here, Brian.
Good to see you, Jolie. It's 25 days out. How do you think the campaign's going?
You know, the campaign is going full steam ahead, obviously. One of the things that's been really exciting is with just 25 days out, a lot more people are starting to pay attention. And I think that's good for Kansas City because this is an important race and we want to make sure that we get as many people to the polls as possible.
You know, you came out, we know, with your first TV commercials this week. They show you talking, among other things, they talk you with talking with voters in a coffee shop. In fact, we want to listen to just a little bit of one of those ads.
I just love this idea of office hours. It made it really nice and made you very accessible.
I want to take City Hall and I want to get down off of the 29th floor and get out onto the ground level and take City Hall to the neighborhoods.
You know, Jolie, I can't help but notice you bring a lot of experience. I think in the primary campaign, we heard you talking about getting things done. These commercials don't really talk about that. How come?
You know, one of the things that I have done for the last 13 years, first as a state senator and now as a city council person, is really try to be the most accessible legislator available. My constituents have appreciated that, and I really wanted to focus on that message because
Are you concerned that message isn't out there?
Well, I think that I've only represented one small fraction of Kansas City, and we're 319 square miles. So I wanted to make sure that I had a conversation with the entire city about the importance of bringing problem solving to the neighborhoods and really being there at that grassroots level, because that's been kind of the crux of my entire career.
What does that mean, bringing problem solving to the neighborhoods? What does that look
like? Sure. So a couple of very concrete things. I mean, we mentioned in the ad that just played that I've had weekly office hours. That's something that I've done since I was in state senate back in 2007, sitting at the same place at the same time every single week. So folks can come to me, whether they're having a development issue in their neighborhood, having an issue with a sidewalk. We can help problem solve by talking to each other, connecting with the neighbors and getting things done. But the kind of taking that to the next level, I have a platform out there right now where we're proposing to do a number of things. Number one, creating a deputy mayor for neighborhoods so that individuals don't have to continue to call six different numbers at City Hall and get six different answers. And so that's one thing. The second thing is I'm committing to once a month being in a district throughout the city with the city manager, with our directors, to actually have City Hall in the neighborhood. And that way, people don't have to worry about taking off of work, missing school. We will be providing childcare for meetings as we move forward so that it's easier to get answers from City Hall.
I guess I'm curious, when you're out there having these office hours or just in the campaign, being out and talking with people, what are they asking you? What seem to be the pressing things that keep coming up again and again?
Yeah, absolutely. When you knock on doors, when you take neighborhood tours, when you make phone calls or text messages, the following things pop up every single time. The first one is always crime. Mm-hmm. And so we are talking about that as a community. The next piece is always sidewalks, streets, and trash. And then the third conversation is always education. And frankly, those are the same three things that we've been hearing as I knocked on doors for state senate as well. These are the issues that are important to neighborhoods, and that's why I'm focusing on the importance of neighborhoods to our city.
Are there some things that they're not asking that either surprise you because you think they maybe should be asking them, or that maybe they're signs of success that we're doing well and people aren't concerned about?
You know, I don't know that there's anything that surprises me. I mean, every now and again, I'll get a question that is so far out of left field that I'm not sure how to answer it.
Sure.
And so I'm always willing to go back and do some research. Every now and again, I get a request for something that I obviously can't resolve, like pitching woes at the Royals Clubhouse and that sort of thing. But I will tell you.
The mayor has some power, but not all power.
Right, yeah. Right. But, you know, really, it's also interesting to me that regardless of what neighborhood you're in, we're all really talking about the same things. We have neighborhoods that have seen some success and they want to see that replicated. We have other neighborhoods who feel like, and rightfully so, have been left behind for decades and want to see that same level of success. And so that's the message that I'm really bringing forward is we need to translate this momentum we've seen in the city into something that improves the quality of life in every single neighborhood.
You know, Julie, I've been out moderating some city council candidate forums, and I'm sure there are some different questions at council candidate forums than at mayor forums. But one thing that comes up in force when people fill out their index cards with their questions are questions about financial incentives for development.
Right.
Tax credits or other financial boosts to promote businesses being built around the city. In a nutshell, what's your plan for reform, if any, of the way we do TIFs and other incentives?
Absolutely. And I think that economic and development incentive reform is absolutely critical and something that we do need to talk about. Because while these tools are incredibly important, and we would not have seen some of the success that we've seen, whether it's putting in a new grocery store at 31st and Prospect, or whether it's revitalizing our downtown, we would not have seen those things without these incentives. And so I have always been a legislator, both at the state level and at the city level, who takes every request on a case-by-case basis. And one of the things that I found is that the first question I always ask is, what is the public benefit? And if there's not one, then the answer is no. There is no incentive that we're going to push forward. So how do we make sure that we're now using those incentives to really have a catalytic effect in neighborhoods that have been left behind or who have been, you know, on the outside of some of these amazing developments that we've seen? And the way that we do that is twofold. We get much more intentional and focused on the neighborhood piece. And so we work with the EDC to start going out and recruiting people to specifically look at neighborhoods. We talk about putting in more community benefits agreements and development agreements to make sure that we're getting a really big bang for our buck. That means putting local people to work on the projects. That means making sure that we're focusing on transportation and housing, which are two critical issues. And then, of course, the other thing is making sure that the boards and commissions that are making these decisions have stakeholders that have a really, really invested interest in making sure that we get this right. And so my commitment is to make sure that all of those boards and commissions are populated by people who know what's important for the city.
So I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. I hear you saying that you would still support the use of these incentives throughout the city, but am I hearing you say that you want to see them used in different parts of the city than they have mostly been used in?
That is correct. I want to use our incentives in parts of the city that have not seen the same level of investment, and I also
like
want
downtown,
to,
like Power and Light.
We have obviously seen a tremendous amount of use of incentives in our downtown core, and that has been vital because the downtown core is essentially the center of the city, and 25% of our economy comes from downtown.
But have we had enough?
You know, you'll never be able to get me to say we've had enough, because if someone came forward tomorrow and said we've got this fantastic opportunity to put in a brand new opportunity for job creation, for educational opportunities on the east side of downtown, I would hate to have said that we're done and that we don't have those tools available.
So,
I don't want to
so
take
it's not a moratorium.
No moratorium. I want to start using the incentives in more creative ways.
Your opponent, Quentin Lucas, has made affordable housing a centerpiece of his campaign. He's the chair of the council's housing committee. You've been critical in some of the forums up till now that more hasn't been done to create affordable housing. Let me ask you specifically, what would you do to create more affordable affordable housing in the city? Specific programs.
Specific programming would start with the issue of what we're already doing, which is a focused development of neighborhoods. I love what they're doing, for instance, in the Likens neighborhood right now, to take vacant and abandoned properties, use pro bono lawyers to get them back onto the tax rolls by suing out-of-state folks who are letting these properties go to waste, and then working with public-private partnerships to rehab the houses and get people back in them. They say there are over 9,000 vacant and abandoned properties right now. We need to make sure that we are getting those properties back on the tax rolls and people living in them. So that's one. That's the preservation piece.
Sure.
On the creation piece, we need to immediately not just talk about it anymore. We need to get an ordinance passed that sets aside affordable housing requirements for all the new developments that are coming through. And that's something that was passed out of Councilman Lucas's committee on February the 6th. It has sat on the floor since that time. And unfortunately, it's been sent back to committee because we still are waiting for answers. We don't know what we're waiting for. We just know that it is out there. We have the opportunity to do it. We need to move that forward now.
And why is that not moving forward? You're waiting for answers. I don't understand what that
means. Well, that's a very good question, and one that unfortunately, you're going to have to ask my opponent, because we were asked that question in a debate 2 weeks ago, and he said that he was waiting to get additional information about making sure that we don't get into a scenario where we are working against people who are trying to build duplexes and fourplexes and sixplexes. And that's fine. If that's just an amendment, we can write it on the floor. But when the actual bill came up to a vote, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, and we asked the questions, Councilman Lucas wasn't there, and we were not able to move it forward. And so I want to know what the holdup is. It's been on the floor since February 6th. And unfortunately, we have seen all of these ordinances. And this isn't just one ordinance. This is a series of ordinances. That the housing policy is still sitting in the committee. All of these things are stalled out. We have a neighborhood housing trust fund with no money in it except for scooter money, which I can't ride enough scooters to fill up that housing trust fund. And so what we need is really firm answers about what we're going to do with the ordinances that have already been proposed.
This is KCUR's Up to Date. We're talking with Councilwoman Jolie Justice, who, of course, is running for mayor. We'll be speaking next Wednesday on the program with her opponent, Councilman Quentin Lucas. Today, we're talking about some of the issues she's trying to address in this campaign. And we've been talking about housing. A lot of our listeners connect the housing questions to another big topic, and that's transportation. Eric on Twitter asked, how do you connect transportation with housing? He notes, affordable housing is desperately needed. It's often too far from jobs. How can the city address that, the connection between places that people can afford to live and being able to get them to their jobs?
Absolutely. And this is one of the issues that has been the hardest for me. And in addition to my work as a senator and a city council person, I've been the director of pro bono services for my law firm for the last 16 years. Most of my work representing kids in the juvenile justice system and kids in the foster care system. And that means I do a lot of social work. And I can typically find housing for one of my clients eventually, but it is never near frequent transportation. It is never near job centers. It is never near the schools where kids need to thrive. And so one of the things that we cannot do is look at housing just as housing. It has to be folded into the transportation piece. And so what would I do specifically, I think, is the next question. And the answer is this. Number one, our housing policy has to have a transportation component. We have to be looking at making sure that when we are giving incentives for housing, that we are incentivizing housing that is on transportation lines. We also have to make sure that every time we have the opportunity to connect through incentives, that maybe you can, there would be greater incentives involved if there's a transportation component along with the housing component. All of these things done in a vacuum, in a silo, are not working. That's why we are where we are today. And that's what I'm proposing that we do, is a more streamlined process.
Is that new, by the way, that proposal to add incentives for projects that are tied into transportation?
That is something that I would add to as part of a broader conversation about economic development reform. I would say that if we are giving incentives, we need to be giving incentives for things like transportation, affordable housing, job creation, and not just bricks and mortar.
Well, I mean, let's talk a little more about transportation, because that's another of those topics that on the index cards at these debates, a lot of people have questions about, whether it's the bike plan or the busing in the city or roads and potholes. You've talked about creating a new Department of Transportation within city government. Give us a little preview. If you were holding the first meeting meeting of the Department of Transportation and giving them their marching orders, what is it that needs to happen right now to address the city's transportation needs?
Cities that moved and have moved in this direction have seen an increase in mobility across the board, which is obviously critically important when we're talking about our most vulnerable citizens. It is helping move people to work, to school, to housing opportunities that we have not seen in the past because you are finally all starting from the same playbook. So here's our big problem right now. We have the Parks Department that is in charge of both planning and constructing streets. We've got Public Works. We've got the Water Department that from time to time needs to interfere with the movement around the city. We've got our utilities. We've got the City Manager's Office. We've got the KCATA and the Streetcar Authority. All of these different entities are trying to address our transportation issues. And we don't have right now a plan other than communicating, you know, through emails that really looks at the long-term strategy of what we're going to do. We've got a great Public Works Department. We've got a great Planning Department. We should not be asking them to do each other's jobs. What we need to do is work forward in a really coordinated way that says, this is the next big project we're going to be doing. And I'm not talking about creating a new bureaucracy. I'm not talking about bringing in the KCATA or the Streetcar Authority under City Hall. That's not what I'm proposing. Instead, what I'm proposing is let's have someone who at the end of the day, the buck stops with them and is able to present to Kansas City, Missouri residents what our plans are, which streets are going to be fixed, and when.
And that is that person would be empowered to actually make changes, or is it more of a situation of just getting people talking to each other?
Well, I think that it would be all of the above. I mean, the reality is that one of the things that I have found to be effective down at City Hall is on a quarterly basis, we sit down with our PIAC reps and let's say the Parks Department, and they explain to us all of the projects that we have been working on with our PIAC dollars and where we are in the process. Why are we not doing more of that on a long-term strategy for how we are going to be planning our streets, our roads, our transportation, and really focusing on all the ways we move around the city, because so many times transportation has been thought of as just automobiles, and that's just not reflective of where we are as a city.
Another question that came out on Twitter this morning from Brian is curious if you think those issues we've been talking about, housing and development and transportation, are those the same issues to be dealt with in the same way in the parts of the city that are north of the river, the parts that are in Platte County and Clay County? I think a lot of times when we talk about those issues, our mind at least goes to Jackson County and some of the realities of dealing with all of those down here on the south side of the river.
You know, one of my pleasures being a 4th District Council person is that I actually represent both Clay and Jackson County. And it was a real eye-opener for me after I got elected, some of the misinformation on both sides of the river. I had constituents south of the river who felt like all the streets in Clay and Platte County were paved in gold. Mm. I had constituents north of the river who felt that they were disproportionately being left out of projects, even though we had data that showed that we were providing those projects. It's just such an expansive area that it didn't feel like it was coming to your neighborhood. And I understand that because when you walk out of your house in the morning, the first thing you see is the thing that's going to bug you all day. Mm. The thing is about Kansas City is we are 319 square miles, and all of these conversations, these neighborhood conversations, are talking about every single part of this city. And so one of the things that we have to do is we have to continue to work to get KCATA service and ride transit, ride KC Transit into the Northland more. It is a growing community that needs more public transportation opportunities. And so we have to focus on that. And I'm excited that we have leadership at the KCATA who's actually working on that right now. We should put a plug in for the fact that if you go to their website right now, you can actually weigh in on future transit lines in Kansas City. And I would highly encourage everyone to do that.
So another of the issues that you mentioned up front as something that people ask you a lot of questions about is crime in the city. And I guess I'd like you to reflect a little bit on what exactly is the crime problem that Kansas City has. I think there's sort of this assumption in every race in every city for city government positions. Oh, yes, I'm going to be tough. I'm going to fight crime. I'm going to address the crime problem. What is the crime problem in Kansas City?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is our homicide rate. when you look at the fact that we are on a top 10 list for most homicides in the country, that is a place that we need to remove ourselves. What's interesting is that some of the work we have been doing both at the state and the local level is actually helping us see a decline in violent crime other than homicides. Mm. And so what we're going to have to do in order to address crime is not be tough on crime, because for decades, that's the approach both the state, the federal government have taken, and all it's resulted in is mass incarceration and communities that are devastated, and it disproportionately impacts Black and brown people. And that is something that I refuse to be a part of. And so for my 8 years down in Jefferson City, I focused on criminal justice reform. We saw a report out of the Vera Institute just 3 weeks ago now that Missouri's prison population is actually declining faster than any other state in the nation. And they pointed out the bills that I passed, the criminal code reform, the Justice Reinvestment Act. Those things are actually starting to make a difference. Now we have to make sure we are starting to come up with very specific deterrence opportunities to work on these specific homicide issues.
A lot of people would say that, those are some concrete things you were able to do as a state senator. But the mayor is a different position. What as mayor can you actually do about crime? The police are controlled by a board that's appointed by state officials. What can you do?
Well, the first and foremost is the police is appointed by a the police are run by a board, and the mayor sits on that board. So bringing that same concept of being smart on crime to the police board is very, very critical. I have seen over and over and over again, when we put our money into social services, when we put our money into smart policing, when we put our money into specialty courts and wraparound services, that's when we start to see a decline in crime. And so I will be sitting on that police board making those decisions. The other thing that is very unique about what I'm proposing, and it's not going to be cheap, but it's a conversation we have to have, is we need more neighborhood police officers. I'm not talking about the folks who are responding to calls throughout the day. Right now, our officers, 80 to 90% of their time is spent responding to calls. And so there's no time to build relationships within our community. As a police board member, I will be focusing on making sure that we shift to a place where we have two additional neighborhood officers per sector, that we keep our social worker program, which is already starting to make a difference, and that we also have a much more robust recruiting effort to make sure that our officers look like our community.
Let me ask you one more question. Are you happy? You've had a chance as a council person to actually observe what's going on at City Hall pretty closely, more closely than most of us. Are you happy with the current administration of City Hall, the city manager, the departments, or do you think there'll be some things that you'll want to shake up there?
You know, it's one of those things when you're a city council person, you get a constituent call and you immediately kick into problem solving mode, and you're very unhappy on one specific day with one thing that's happening. And so you want to try to fix it. And what I have seen is that we have an amazing city manager. We have an amazing set of city employees who are really doing a fantastic work. Are there things we need to address where we have dropped the ball? Oh, yeah, we've got a lot of work to do. But we've got some really interesting tools in place that I look forward to implementing to improve that performance. Our KC Stat program, it's been wonderful for the last 8 years. It's trying to take it to the next level and really use it to solve the systemic problems we've seen in some departments to make sure that citizens not only know that their problems are going to be addressed, but when they're going to be addressed. And we need to get that information much, much easier to the constituents. And so those will be focuses of my campaign as well.
That's Councilwoman Jolie Justice. She's running for mayor of Kansas City, and we'll be talking with her opponent on Wednesday next week. Also, don't forget to join us on Thursday, June 6th, for a live debate between the two of them at the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce. That will also air live here on Up to Date. Jolie Justice, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Brian.
When we return, our film critics will join us with movie reviews just in time for the holiday weekend. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Thursday on the program, we talked with experts who study the reasons why some women make the decision to have an abortion. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. We'll be off on Monday, but KCUR will air special programming for Memorial Day. Join us again on Tuesday as we continue our conversations with the candidates running for Kansas City Council. Sometimes this holiday weekend at the end of May serves as an introduction to summer. Sometimes it is filled with the threat of thunderstorms that make it a great time to head to a local theater to enrich your mind, fill your heart, or watch high school nerds learn how to party. Here to help you plan are our critics, Cindy Haynes, retired film professor and a member of the Kansas City Film Critics Circle. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good morning.
Steve Walker, also a member of the Kansas City Film Critics Circle.
Yes, thank you, Brian.
Well, and while we're at it, another member of the Kansas City Film Critics Circle, Bob Butler, whose reviews you can read at butlercinemascene.com.
Good morning.
And we're glad you're all here. Let's jump right in to the first movie on our list. Opening today, Shadow. It was a movie about Tai Chi and intrigue in an ancient Chinese court, Bob.
I guess that sums it up. Listen, this was made by Yimou Zhang, who in the 1990s was the hot Chinese director. He did Raise the Red Lantern and Zhu Du. He was terrific. About 20 years ago, he discovered Kung Fu, and now it's like Martin Scorsese making Marvel movies. Huh. What I mean by that is, this is one of the most beautiful visual movies you'll ever see. It's a tale of intrigue set in an ancient Chinese court. It's shot almost entirely using black and white production design. The only colors are human flesh and blood, of which there's a ton.
Right.
Wow.
It's drop-dead gorgeous, and it's full of this kind of palace intrigue that I find numbing. It just bores the hell out of me.
One thing that
seems so positive right up until that moment.
One of my favorite images in any movie this year involves these umbrellas made out of blades that one of the warring factions utilize. There's a scene where they're sidling down a hill, all of them spinning in these umbrellas like crabs that you'd see in a nature movie. It's amazingly beautiful.
The special effects are fantastic. Yeah. Set design is brilliant. Costume design. So visually, it's stunning is the appropriate word. It really is. But I agree, Bob. I mean, there's such a convoluted story about shadows and doppelgangers.
Well, there's a general. He's dying, and he has gotten a lookalike to portray him in the court, and that is the shadow of the title. They're both played by the same actor.
Interesting.
A guy named Chow Deng, and in fact, he's so good in both those roles that I could hardly believe that he was the same actor doing both.
So we'd love to
play a clip for you, but it's in Mandarin, so it may not be helpful for most of our
listeners.
Gives
you a chance to practice your
It's
Chinese.
Playing at Screenland Armor. So check it out.
It's definitely worth the effort.
It's worth a big screen
view. Yeah,
it really
bet.
Is.
Yeah.
Don't watch it on your cell phone.
Moving right along, the aforementioned high school nerds learning how to party. Cindy, tell us about Booksmart.
Well, this is my favorite entertaining movie of the year so far. It's a celebration of friendship from a female point of view, which is really nice to see. It's rather ironic that one of the two nerdy girls happens to be the sister of none other than Jonah Hill of Superbad. So we've got that must
sort
have been
a full
part,
circle
part
here.
Of the genre,
yeah.
Right, coming back around.
Exactly. And these nerdy girls try to assimilate, but they also deal with prejudices. And that's the big surprise in the film, is people make assumptions about each other, even the ones, you know, you think, should know better. Anyway, I just find it to be terribly entertaining.
We have a little clip, actually, from the film. What are we going to hear?
It is Let's Go to a Party.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Let's go to Nick's party.
Are you kidding? No, no way.
We only have one night left to have studied and partied in high school. Otherwise, we're just going to be the girls that missed out. We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Okay. We've broken a lot of rules. One, we have fake IDs.
Fake college IDs so we can get into their 24-hour library.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
Yes, he broke art rules. Name a person who broke a real rule.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
Susan
one.
Susan B. Anthony.
God damn it.
See, I mean, it is so clever. It really has you laughing the whole time. Directed by actress Olivia Wilde. And she did an excellent job of casting Beanie Feldstein, who plays Molly, and Caitlin Deaver, who plays Amy, and these two gals together are magic.
Little role there for Kansas City's own Jason Sudeikis as well.
Who happens to be the fiancé of Olivia Wilde. But I appreciate the fact that the gay characters in this film aren't marginalized, that women are portrayed as intelligent beings. And we have Lisa Kudrow and Will Forte, who happen to be good friends of Olivia's, do a little cameo in there, too. So great fun, very entertaining.
Opens today.
Opens today.
I did not get to see it.
Yep, it's a good movie. It really is. Do not think that it's super bad redux. It's got its own thing.
Right. Very it looks good. Great. It's gotten great reviews. Yeah.
Well, in about as different a movie as I can imagine transitioning to next, we have with White Crow, a dramatic account of the great Russian ballet dancer, Steve, Rudolf Nureyev.
Well, Nureyev left Russia in 1961 to go to Paris with the Kirov Ballet, and that is when he defected. So Ralph Fiennes, the actor, has directed this film, and he follows his life only as a child and shot in this really muted, almost black and white colors, the very faded, like memories fade.
Soviet Union during the war.
Yeah.
Pretty grim.
And then it follows him up to 61, so it's... it doesn't like follow him till his death or follow him through his adult life and his renown. He does get famous before he defects. The actor who plays Nureyev is a dancer. He's a great dancer, not a great actor.
But it made a lot of sense to cast a dancer.
Well, of course,
This term White Crow, the title of the film, are we supposed to be thinking about Black Swan when we think of White Crow?
No, we're not quite there.
Actually, it's an idiom used to describe a person who is unusual.
An iconoclast.
Yes, not like others, an outsider.
I will say about the quarter of the film is... the defection itself.
And that's the most dramatic part.
It's thrilling, and we know what happens.
Yeah, it's thrillingly directed. It's really great.
By Ralph Fiennes, who plays Nureyev's teacher, Pushkin. I think he was the weakest link in the whole movie. He was very, very dull.
Which isn't said too often about Ralph Fiennes.
No.
We have a clip. Nureyev was living with Pushkin and his wife, and kind of dallying around with her, anyway. And so here in this scene, he's got a German boyfriend, and they're discussing his living arrangement.
Пушкин не возражает, потому что он слабак.
Nothing to say.
Why not?
Because nothing to say.
You like living with her? Suits you, does it? Нравится, да? Living with a married couple? Rudy, I'm going to have to explain to you we have something called friends. Друзья. Friends talk about things.
Then I don't want to be friends.
You can lie to her, but you can't lie to me.
All right, White Crow, which opens today.
Yep.
Moving on, a film called Photograph. This one is set in India, Bob. Tell us about it.
Well, you know how you say Indian cinema and immediately you think Bollywood? Mm-hmm. Dancing, singing, sexless romance, right?
Yes.
Forget it. It's not what this film not here. This is a different side of Indian filmmaking. Ritesh Batra has made a story about two people. They're kind, how shall I put this? They're at dead ends in their lives. A man, a woman, they come together. The man is Rafa, played by Nawazuddin Siddiqui.
Wow.
He's a guy from the country, comes to Mumbai to earn a living. He takes photographs of tourists, and he takes a photograph of this girl. She's maybe 20, 21. She's not particularly beautiful or anything like that. She's an accountant. She's not girly in any way, shape, or form. And the two of them form an alliance. It's a very, I wouldn't even call it sweet. It's very perceptive, though, about people who really don't have many options. I was telling my colleagues here, I think the whole movie was based on the famous Ernest Borgnine movie, Marty. That was the one about a Bronx butcher and a shy girl who find romance, and something like that is happening here.
Did you enjoyed it?
I enjoyed it. Not wildly enthusiastic about it, but I did enjoy it.
Their alliance is purposely for impressing his grandmother, who visits from the country.
His very domineering,
grandmother. who they called grandma's doties there. And so it's all a sham, but they do start to fall for each other, which is not unpredictable.
The plot
at all.
Sounds like it could be a sitcom, but it isn't played as a sitcom at all.
There's nothing funny about it.
No. Right. It's nice. I liked it a lot.
The film, again, is Photograph, and that opens today as well. Coming up next, a documentary featuring a filmmaker John Chester and his wife Molly and sustainable farming, Steve.
I love this movie so much. It's about a couple from Los Angeles. He's a photographer. She's a chef. He's a cinematographer, actually, mm-hmm. on nature documentaries. And they get this idea. They want a farm. They want, they're tired of the city life, and they do a Kickstarter-like campaign and buy 200 acres an hour from L.A., and then just learn how dang hard it is to run a farm and keeping the animals healthy and keeping the predators off their property and keeping the snails off the trees. And it's so fun. And I've lived downtown for 12 years. I want to move to a farm.
Wow. The name of the film, I should say, is The Biggest Little Farm.
Right.
And we actually have a little clip of it. What are we going to hear?
Well, it's a very fun clip. It's they're talking about, he's talking about their pig named Emma and her boyfriend that is actually a chicken they call Mr. Greasy.
All right. Let's give it a listen.
Update on Emma the pig. The day before she is to give birth yet again. And then there's the nervous boyfriend, Mr. Greasy. A little something for them to reflect back on the good times when life was simple.
Aww.
Any guess what color the babies are going to be?
That's a clip from The Biggest Little Farm.
And it's not all sweetness and light.
No,
I mean, animals, farm animals die. They have a cycle of life, right?
And the movie starts out with them wanting to live in harmony with nature. And they seem so naive and you're just, and arrogant almost in a way. Mm-hmm. And you see this transition over the course of 8 years of how they've truly brought life back to the earth. They worked with a man named Alan York who dies partway through the film, who was a
spoiler alert.
I'm sorry. He's an expert in biodynamics. It's foreshadowed in the very beginning.
Sure.
So anyway, and he's the one who was telling them what to plant, how to plant, when, and made a big difference in their lives. So they always pay tribute to him.
Now, the story is about a filmmaker, but this isn't his film. He's the subject.
No, he is.
He made his own.
Yeah. He's the director.
That's why it's so stunning. I mean, I've watched a lot of nature movies, but his cinematography really made all of those farm animals come to life.
And one more thing it's so fascinating. They figure out how to take the starlings, the beetles, the squids, and the coyotes that are killing their crops and animals and turn it around and figure out where all these animals fit in the
ecosystem.
Yes, right. Ecosystem. Thank you.
The squids are killing their animals? Is that what you're saying?
The squids, they get on top of the baby pigs, and you've got 48 snails on you. It's kind of hard to walk.
That's hard. It's even hard to listen to, actually. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the Biggest Little Farm, which also opened today. Next up is a film called Trial by Fire. And this is a different kind of story, Bob, a controversial story of a man executed for killing his three children.
Yeah, this is a movie that just hearing what it's about, you go, not today. I'm not feeling like this.
Right.
I have to admit, I got sucked in much more than I expected to.
I so did. Yeah.
It's directed by Edward Zwick, who you remember from the TV show 30-something and the movie Glory. He's a director who's made some big movies. This is small. This is intimate. Todd Willingham was a Texan, a father, who back in the early 90s woke up to find his house on fire. He was later charged with starting the fire, which killed his three children and placed on death row. Now, he's played by Jack O'Connell, who was in Unbroken, the Angelina Jolie movie. He's a British actor, but he comes off beautifully as a Texan.
He does. Yeah.
And the great thing about this movie is you spend the first maybe 40 minutes hating the guy, because even if he didn't kill his children, he was like the poster boy for, you know, poverty level bad behavior. Mm-hmm. He cheated on his wife. He went out drinking. He did love his kids, though. And that becomes the thing that you follow throughout this years of incarceration. Sometimes, you know, I like to say intimacy may make, knowing this guy, you start to feel for him. About halfway through, Laura Dern shows up as a writer who almost by accident comes across his case and starts agitating to have that looked at again. We have a clip. You ready?
We do. Tell us about
this. Is her approaching the public defender that handled the case badly.
This is from Trial by Fire.
They denied him habeas corpus. You're asking the state to reopen a case based on character witnesses when the primary factor in his conviction was the arson investigation. Now, I have to agree with the experts here, Miss Gilbert. Fire does not lie. Look, you've been kind to him, and I admire that. A personal involvement can blind you to the truth. I've been there. Just don't let your emotions get the better of you.
My emotions?
What?
Because I'm a woman?
That's not what I meant.
Well, then why don't you enlighten me?
Have sympathy for the man he's become. Don't forget about the man he was.
Great. I'm going to go finish your job for you.
I kept thinking about Dead Man Walking at the beginning
exactly.
of the film.
Sure, yeah.
But then I veered off and I said, this is a totally different story about capital punishment, and it's as effective emotionally as Dead Man Walking.
And it may not go where you might think it would go if
Which
it was
makes
a TV
it interesting,
movie.
Right.
Her friends tell Laura Dern's character, don't become one of those sad women who enters a death row romance. Don't. It looks like that's what's happening, but watch yourself. And I love Laura Dern. I love watching her.
Now, the great thing, one of the sad things about this, the last thing you see is a title that tells you the state of Texas has yet to admit they executed an innocent man. So there you go.
Spoiler alert. You're listening to
them today,
the
apparently.
Film critics on KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison. I'm here with Cindy Haynes and Steve Walker and Bob Butler. And next up is Red Joan, which is a fictionalized version of the life of a real person, the KGB's longest-serving British spy, Steve.
Well, all we can really say is that Judi Dench is in it. And
well,
for some
I'm
of our
there, then. Yeah,
for some of our
it.
Listeners, that would be plenty. And it should be, because she's great in it. She's not in it a lot, but she plays a real true woman named Joan Stanley, who was arrested for being a KGB spy when she was in her 80s. Seems like she worked at a place where they worked on the bomb when she was a young woman, and has not thought about it for years and years and years until she's knock at the door and there's the British police. Then a lot of the movie is the backstory of... Not the backstory, the flashback to when she was a young woman and in school and working at this place.
And the young actress Sophie Cookson plays the young Joan, and I think does a wonderful, wonderful job. She held her own.
Between her and Judi Dench.
Yeah, well done.
Well, let's listen to a clip. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Dench talking to the press after her release, sort of explaining her rationale for what she did.
This is from Red Joan.
I am not... a spy.
You moved to Russia, Miss Julia.
I don't believe in working against one's country. I wanted the Russians to be on an equal footing with the West. I'm not a traitor. I wanted everyone to share the same knowledge. Because...
How much did the Russians pay you?
Because only that way could the horror of another world war be averted. And I think if you look back at history, you'll see I was right.
I could have on my bucket list Judi Dench reading me stories.
Yes, or reading the phone book.
Oh, my God.
It would be
her
fine.
Voice
yeah.
is just amazing.
You know, what I found really interesting about this is watching this movie, I was thinking of modern-day, quote-unquote, spies, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, and wondering what their motivations were.
Mm-hmm.
Because this really...
Yeah,
it explains why someone might do this.
It's a very current topic,
yeah.
really.
Give the bomb to the scary Russians
so that
no one else will dare do anything.
Yeah.
Right. Next up, a film that's been out now a couple of weeks in wide release, but worth talking about. Cindy, the biopic about J.R.R. Tolkien.
Well, it's basically the origin story of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and I think it's a disadvantage if you haven't read the books and if you're not familiar with the language. It's a fascinating story. Nicholas Holt plays the great writer. He's been in the films about a boy, X-Men, The Favorite, A Single Man. But he just didn't seem to have the heft that was required of portraying a man like Tolkien. He covers three different periods in the course of his life, when he was an orphan and then became a writer and then a college professor. And it's interesting to see the transition in his life. But
what are we going to hear?
We are going to hear him talking with his professor, Derek, played by Derek Jacobi.
Let's give it a listen.
Professor?
Since childhood, I have been fascinated with language, obsessed with it. I've invented my own. Full, complete languages. Look, this is, it's everything. From the breast hoard, my heart, the treasure of the breast.
And the drawings?
I made stories, legends. After all, what is language for? It's not just the naming of things, is it? It's the lifeblood of a culture, a people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that clip, I think, illustrates, you could look at Tolkien as this great mind, but I think you could also look at him as a crazy person in some way, right?
Well, in a way. It's just too traditional a biopic. I think that's what was frustrating for me.
Didn't bring out enough of the crazy?
It was kind of fun because I saw it at the Regal Theater. It was a Fathom event, and the actors and the director appear live on screen after you watch the film, and there are other people asking questions. But,
if you're still awake.
Steve Walker, I don't usually ask critics who have not seen the film to comment on it, but boy, you have a lot of opinions about it.
I don't know anything about The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien, anything, and I just, it's one
but
of those
movies.
But if you
watch the movie,
I have no interest in it.
You
nothing.
Might.
No interest.
All right, well, okay. Fair enough. See Tolkien if you want to, and don't
sort of.
If you don't want to.
That's the point of our show. Isn't it?
That's exactly right. And there is one more film to talk about, which is also in pretty good contrast to Tolkien. It's a documentary about the Church of Satan, Steve.
It is. And I want to talk about it because whatever you think this movie is going to be about, it upends everything you thought that they were about. In fact, the point being that they are mostly about separation of church and state and social justice issues, and they couldn't be more aligned with me personally on things that they care about
in terms of the issues
and that matter to them. And so watching Satanists who you have this stereotype about go, I'm right there with you. It's very interesting. And it's playing at Liberty Hall. It's eye-opening as heck. So
That is probably not what people were expecting to hear about a movie on the Church of Satan.
They're offbeat a little bit, so we don't have a clip, I don't think.
No, we don't have a clip, and we are, in fact, out of time, but I want to say thank you to Steve Walker.
Thank you.
I should say again, the name of that film is Hail Satan.
Hail Satan,
for those who
Liberty Hall in Lawrence.
And that's the only time I believe I have ever said those words on the radio.
in life.
Yes, or in life, right. Certainly not from the pulpit. Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler, thank you all so much for being here today. Coming up, remember, don't forget, looking back, Thursday on the program, we talked with the architect of the Music Genome Project. He explained the science of why we like the music we do. You can hear that at kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. I'm at PTSBrian. Also, don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. As many observe Memorial Day on Monday, KCUR will have special programming during this hour. And then don't forget to come back on Tuesday when Steve Kraske will be back for a look at injuries in youth sports. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a safe, great holiday weekend, everyone. And you are up to date.